From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with jazz pianist Fred Hirsch. His 1993 trio recording of classic ballads won a Grammy nomination. He has a new solo album. His work is also represented on several new recordings to benefit AIDS organizations. Hirsch learned he was HIV positive in 1986, but only recently revealed that to his audience. Also today, we meet the writer and director of the new film Backbeat, about the early days of the Beatles before they recorded, when they had a fifth member, Stu Sutcliffe, the band's first bass player. And jazz critic Evan Whitehead reviews guitarist Bill Frisell's new album, This Land. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. A United Nations spokesman says the Bosnian Serbs have offered a new immediate ceasefire around Garajda, but the Serbs apparently haven't stopped firing on the town. Earlier, the UN commander in Bosnia said shells were falling heavily on Garajda. Thousands of panicky refugees are cowering in the streets because there's no shelter for them. UN Commander General Michael Rose says he won't order any more NATO airstrikes. Seven British officers in Garajda to direct the raids have been evacuated. The Russian envoy to Bosnia is strongly criticizing the Serbs. Vitaly Churkin says he's never seen so many broken promises. He's even calling on his government to break off talks with the Serbs. The French relief group Doctors Without Borders is calling for the resignation of the UN special envoy to Bosnia. The aid group says Yasushi Akashi is a professional liar. And Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
Head of Doctors Without Borders, Honi Bauman, called on UN envoy Yasushi Akashi to resign for his handling of the Serbian assault against the Muslim enclave of Garajda. Bauman said at the very moment when Serbian forces were firing on Garajda and when the hospital was being hit, Akashi declared that a ceasefire was in place and that UN troops would be able to move into Garajda. Bauman said just the opposite was true. He said, "We can't accept that a professional liar represents the international community in such a dramatic situation." Also today, the French Foreign Minister, Alain Juppé, said officials from the United States, the European Union, Russia, and the UN should meet in the next few days to establish a common position in hopes of relaunching the peace process. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
A Palestinian with an axe and two firebombs attacked bus passengers in Jerusalem today as they were getting off the vehicle. The attacker and four Israelis were hurt. NPR's Paul Miller reports.
The attack happened in the Jerusalem neighborhood of Neve Yaakov in the northernmost part of the city near the border with the West Bank. Police say a 25-year-old Israeli Arab from East Jerusalem attacked people with an axe as they got off a bus. A soldier near the bus shot the attacker and may have wounded some passengers by mistake. The Palestinian extremist group Hamas said it was responsible for today's attack. It has also claimed responsibility for several others, which took place on buses or at bus stops. 12 Israelis were killed in two Hamas suicide attacks on buses this month. The Israeli government is continuing security operations and a diplomatic offensive against Hamas, which has promised to continue to attack Israelis. I'm Paul Miller in Jerusalem.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are down 41 points at 3,624. Trading is heavy. The Nasdaq is down 7 at 720. This is NPR. The Federal Reserve has acted to raise short-term interest rates. This is the third increase this year. The boost is certain to lift a variety of business and consumer rates higher. The last two increases set off a frenzy of selling on Wall Street as worried investors sold stocks and bonds. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan says the central bank will tighten its pressure on its reserves. Analysts say the result will be an interest rate hike of about a quarter of a point. The previous two rate increases, each a quarter of a point, boosted the short-term interest rate from 3 to 3.5%. The Environmental Protection Agency is urging people who own wells to have their water tested for lead. The announcement comes as two environmental groups are suing the makers of a certain kind of drinking water pump. NPR's John Nielsen reports.
The Natural Resources Defense Council and the Environmental Defense Fund say unsafe levels of lead are leaching out of several new brands of submersible water pipes made with leaded brass parts. These pumps are used all over the country in privately owned drinking water wells. EPA officials say it's not clear how many private well owners are threatened by the pumps, but the agency has urged people who've installed a leaded brass pump in the last year to consider drinking bottled water until their well water can be tested. The announcement comes as Congress prepares to reauthorize the Safe Drinking Water Act. Environmentalists want it strengthened. Critics say it requires expensive, unnecessary testing. Water in private wells is currently not tested under the act. Lead is toxic. At low levels, it's been linked to learning disabilities in children. I'm John Nielsen, reporting.
The space shuttle Endeavour is taking pictures of the Himalayas today. The mountain range is home to the world's tallest peaks. Astronauts are using a sophisticated radar system to collect three-dimensional photos of the mountains. The information could help people living in the region find out how much of their drinking water will come from melted snow. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Pianist Fred Hirsch has a new recording of If I Loved You, which reminded me of what a beautiful song it is. We'll hear it in a moment. The song is featured on Hirsch's new solo album, recorded live at Maybeck Recital Hall. His previous trio album, Dancing in the Dark, was nominated for a Grammy. This is a busy season for Hirsch, with his work represented on 7 new and forthcoming CDs. Several of them are to benefit people with AIDS and AIDS research. Hirsch learned he was HIV positive in 1986. It's only recently that he's been public about that. He's asymptomatic and very active as a performer, composer, and producer. Before pursuing his solo career, he played with such well-known musicians as Stan Getz, Art Farmer, and Joe Henderson. Let's get started with If I Loved You from Fred Hirsch's new recording, Fred Hirsch at Maybeck.
There's certain traps to avoid in general when you're improvising music. Over the years, I've gotten to work as a sideman with people that I really consider to be masters, and a few people that have given me a couple of like kernels of wisdom that have really helped me, which I pass then along to all the students that I work with. I can remember. The very first record I made with Art Farmer as a sideman in around 1979, which would have been for Concord Jazz, I think, and I was trying so hard. I wanted it to be so perfect and so great, and I wanted, you know, and Art took me aside in a very kind of fatherly way. He said, you know, all you can do when you're recording or when you're playing a solo is just try to make sense from phrase to phrase, like a conversation. And for some reason, that was like just the right thing to hear at just the right time. So that's one of the things that you probably should avoid as an improviser is just trying too hard or having an agenda, wanting to play a lot of fast stuff or wanting to impress somebody or impress a critic or wanting to play kind of far out, rather than just playing whatever is going on at the moment, hearing it, letting it affect what you play next, and letting the whole thing unfold. That's what I like about a ballad, is, you know, just the pace of allowing it to unfold.
You mentioned that nice analogy that Art Farmer gave you that, about, you know, playing should be like a conversation where one phrase naturally
falls another. Yeah, just let it unfold.
Mm-hmm. You know, in your new album, it's solo at Maybach Recital Hall. So, of course, you can't really be having a conversation in that respect.
Right.
It's more like a monologue, but you don't want it to sound like a speech.
Right.
Is it hard to play solo?
Actually, I enjoy playing solo. I use a lot of... you know, a lot of left-hand stuff and counterpoint inner voices and those, and that stuff comes out really nicely, obviously, when you're playing by yourself. But you did hit on something, that the important thing is to not make it into like a presentation, like here's a bunch of stuff that I learned how to play and now I'm just going to kind of lay it on you. So what I did on this particular recording is probably at least, of the ones that ended up on the tape, on the CD, probably three or four I had never really performed before at all, including If I Loved You. I just figured that way I can surprise myself. I announce to the audience, hey, I'm going to play some things that I know very well, and I'm going to play some things that I don't know at all, and let's see what happens. So I was kind of reading, sight reading, more or less, with very little preparation. That way I knew those things would be fresh and I would be involved in them. I don't know if that makes any sense, but...
Sounds risky to me.
Yeah, well, I prefer to operate that way. For me, I'd rather... Sometimes the first few times I play something, it's the freshest, and then it gets a little more contrived, or I start to compete with myself.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, when I record with a trio... What we do is, rather than record one song over and over till we get it right, we record in sets. So we'll put together a set of three or four songs, just like we're playing in a club. Then we'll take a break. Then we'll do three or four more songs. And we'll just do a whole bunch of different sets without worrying about, you know, what comes out, what we like or what we don't like until the dust settles. And so with a solo concert, I just had this list of tunes, and I just decided at the spur of the moment which tune I would play and what I would do with it. And it kept it, for me, it kept me from getting, nervous or predictable.
You have been working on several albums to benefit AIDS. And in a minute, I want to play a really beautiful song that you wrote that's featured on one of these forthcoming records. It's from the AIDS Quilt songbook. The song is called Blues for an Imaginary Valentine. Is there a story behind writing the song?
Yeah, there is, actually. I had met William Parker, who was the baritone recital singer who commissioned, if you will, this whole series. And the AIDS Quilt Songbook was originally performed in New York at Lincoln Center about 2 years ago. And Will had gotten this. Will was sick at the time. He's since passed away. And he got the idea of getting a bunch of different contemporary classical composers, each to write a song for baritone voice and piano, presumably, using a contemporary text on AIDS. He was very emphatic about that. He did not want settings of Walt Whitman or Rilke or anything like that. And I had known of this project, and I tracked him down through an opera singer friend of mine. I called him up, and I said, Will, you know, I'd like to come... I'd like to get involved in this. And Will was very kind of brusque. He said, oh, we couldn't possibly, we're full up, and, you know, maybe in next year if we do it again. And I said, well, Will, you know, I'm HIV positive myself. So, you know, although I'm asymptomatic, you know, I'd rather not wait till next year. So Will said, oh, well, that's a different story. Why don't you come over? And so I went to his house and we started talking, and he played me a few of the songs that he had already, that had already been slated for this song cycle. And I was very impressed with the level of the work and also the kind of people that he had, was able to get to participate in this thing, some major composers. And he gave me a book of poetry called Poets for Life. And he said, maybe you'll find something in here. And anyway, I just sort of left Will's house, and the whole thing kind of came together in a matter of just a few days. It was a very fast process. And I've never written a, quote, art song before, nor have I written any real poetry before. But I felt like I had a point of view in this song, talking about, you know, two people who are both ill, and, you know, one kind of always expected to be the last one to go, and now he finds himself being the first one to go.
Did you write it from that perspective, because that's the position the singer was in who commissioned the song?
Not really. I mean, it's not autobiographical, nor is it about Will. It's just, I thought it was an interesting point of view, because, you know, it's also about... you know, if anything, perhaps it's autobiographical in that, as I've gotten older, I've grown to understand that you know, love, or, you know, real love, is not necessarily having somebody there for you, but being able to be there for somebody else. And this person who's singing this song has great regret that they're not going to be able to be there for this other person the way that they wanted to be. So I felt like, you know, it's a more you know, noble point of view, or what have you, and it just was something that I wanted to express, and it just sort of came out that way.
Now, you said you wrote this for a baritone named William Parker, uh-huh. But the singer I believe we're going to hear is William Sharp.
That's correct. Will got three of his friends, who are probably Will and these other three gentlemen, Sanford Sylvan, William Sharp, and Kurt Ullman, are probably the finest young American baritone recital singers by far. And when we performed the concert, Will, first of all, physically was not up to singing 16 songs or 17 songs, and he generously kind of divided them up so that each singer sang four or five songs. And when we recorded it, each singer recorded the songs that he had sung in the concert.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's hear your song. It's called Blues for an Imaginary Valentine. My guest, Fred Hirsch, at the piano. William Sharp is the baritone. The music and words written by Fred Hirsch.
Now I grieve. Not for myself, but for you, whom I leave behind, and for you who must face death.
A song by my guest, Fred Hirsch, who's featured at the piano. William Sharp was the baritone. When you acknowledged that you were HIV positive, were you worried that it would have any adverse effects on you professionally? And were you surprised by the reaction you actually got?
That's a tough one to answer. I think at this point, as a pianist, as an artist, as a musician, as a composer, you know, I figure... people like me or they don't at this point. You know, I've made a lot of records. I've performed a lot in a lot of situations. I figure at this point people are going to like me or they're not going to like me. I'm not coming out about my HIV status in any exploitive way or to get any kind of pity or sympathy from anybody. But I feel like just on a personal level, the energy that's been created by my coming out of the AIDS closet and of the closet in general has had a really beneficial effect on me as an artist, as a performer. I feel like this kind of music, jazz music, and the kind of music that I write, it demands being comfortable with yourself. And if you're hiding something, it's very difficult to have to be comfortable with yourself musically and personally. So I just felt like the benefits would far outweigh whatever little consequences there might be, or people who are either AIDS paranoid or homophobic. I can't control that in the world anyway.
How do you feel that your music was inhibited when you were in the closet, either as a gay person or as someone HIV positive?
Well, when I first came to New York in 77, after I got out of music school, I began sort of living a double life. I would go around and in the gay world, and then I had kind of the jazz world, and they didn't seem to ever coincide. And it got to the point where I was getting paranoid that some of the band leaders that I was working at the time would find out about my personal life. So I just kept everything very, very quiet. I'll recount a story. I was playing with Stan Getz in 1982, and he had come over to the house for a rehearsal. And I'd been living with a lover for about 2 years at that time, and I'd been very kind of quiet about it. And I remember Stan walking down my hallway. I have a loft and a long hallway. He was walking down this hallway, and I ran into the bathroom, and I hid my lover's toothbrush because I didn't want him to see that there were two toothbrushes, and he might think, well, you know. I mean, it was totally nuts, really. It was crazy. You know, I was just paranoid and nuts. And after he left, I thought, who cares? You know, I mean, so what? So I began to talk more openly about it. Now, the jazz world has certainly a reputation as kind of a macho, womanizing, you know, all that kind of stuff. And to be honest, I've had to, you know, for a long time, sit and listen to you know, things that I would not probably find as humorous as some of the people who are telling them.
My guest is pianist Fred Hirsch. His new solo album is called Fred Hirsch at Maybeck. His song Blues for an Imaginary Valentine is on the album The AIDS Quilt Songbook. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with jazz pianist Fred Hirsch. When you were thinking of coming out, were you more afraid of the reaction of musicians of an older generation that you were playing with, musicians of, say, Stan Getz's generation, and musicians who were considered giants, but who were older than you were, and who, for generational reasons, might mm-hmm. not have been as comfortable with the idea?
Yes, at first I would definitely say so. But it's interesting, and this is another, you know, one of these ironies, that some of the people of that generation who I have now been open about, who I've been open with, they've been very supportive, interested, interesting. I was traveling with Toots Thielemans, the harmonica player, in Europe, and it was about the second night of a 2-week tour. And there was the trio and Toots, and the other two members of the band, they certainly knew what was going on with me in terms of being gay. And after dinner, everybody, I don't know, it was just one of these things where everybody kind of pulled out their wallets and started showing pictures of their girlfriends or wives or children. And I felt very kind of left out. And Toots, who's a very sweet guy, he looked over at me and said, you know, I really hope you meet a young lady that you can be happy with. I'm so happy with my wife and blah, blah, blah. You know, and I knew it was motivated by a very, you know, sincere desire for my well-being. Well, as it happened the next day, Toots and I were on a train sharing a compartment in the train. And I said, you know, Toots, I really appreciate what you said to me last night about, you know, helping that I find a young lady to share my life with. And it's a lovely thought. Just change the sex. Just say to yourself that you hope I find a nice young man or a nice man. And he just sort of looked at me and just looked for a second. And he said, well, that'll take some getting used to, but okay, you know. And now when I talk to him, he always asks, hey, are you seeing somebody? Or if I've been seeing somebody, we've been invited as a couple to his home. You know, and I feel like it was a risk. But if you want to have any kind of intimate relationship with anybody, you know what your sexual orientation is or whether or not you have a potentially fatal illness is a prerequisite to any kind of intimacy. You can't say, oh, such and such is a good friend of mine, but they don't know anything about you. So the reason that I do talk about it is to hopefully be more real and more interesting and more interested.
I want to get back to ballads again, and I guess I'm wondering if you found yourself gravitating any more toward ballads when you found out that you were HIV positive, if there was a level of either sadness or nostalgia or something like that that you found in ballads that just related to you emotionally.
I think on some level maybe, but I think mostly the emphasis on the last couple of albums has been on the Blues for Imaginary Valentine and the Tango Notwithstanding. I think the emphasis for me has been on just playing the record of standards I did last year, the record of jazz composers that'll be coming out in May, both with my trio. The emphasis has just been on playing. I found people that I'm very, very happy playing with. I found a trio that I'm just very pleased with. And so I just wanted to get the focus back on just playing, on not, you know, fancy material, nothing pretentious. Just kind of back to basics, back to the kind of tunes that I started to that I played when I kind of first started playing jazz, you know, 20 years ago. And in a way, I'm trying not to be morbid about this and seeing this as some summation of my life's work or anything. It's just kind of what I'm enjoying doing is just going in the studio and just playing some tunes, and I feel like, as a player, I'm at the level where I think that in itself would be perceived as some sort of statement.
Fred Hirsch's new album, Live at Maybeck, is on Concord Jazz. The AIDS Quilt Songbook is on Harmonia Mundi Nightingale. His new trio album will be released next month on Chesky. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Thank you. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the early days of the Beatles. We talk with Ian Softley about writing and directing the new film Backbeat. It covers one of the lesser-known periods of the Beatles' career when they were just getting started, working out their sound in the clubs of Hamburg. The band assembled for the soundtrack features musicians from Sonic Youth, R.E.M., and Nirvana. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new album by guitarist and composer Bill Frisell. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Clinton administration is reviewing options in the Allied effort to end the Bosnian Civil War. We have more from NPR's Mara Liasson at the White House.
As he left for a health care event in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, the president said that the last few days had not been a great weekend for the peace effort. He called the situation disappointing and difficult, and he asked his national security team to review the options and decide what to do next. The president accused the Serbs of once again breaking ceasefire agreements. He pointed out that for the first time, the Serbs had broken an agreement with the Russians, their historical allies in the region. He repeated his support for an end to the arms embargo on the Bosnian Muslims, suggesting that maybe this time, the French and English, who have opposed such a move in the past, might be more supportive. But Mr. Clinton said it was unlikely the U.S. would move on its own to arm the Muslims. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
The African National Congress says it had nothing to do with the five men who were held all weekend in the basement of its Johannesburg headquarters. An ANC spokesman said the incident stemmed from a private investigation by a security guard whose car was broken into. South African police say they've released the four men and a teenager. All had reportedly been severely beaten. They say the five identified themselves as members of the Inkatha Freedom Party. That's the ANC's political rival. Inkatha also opposes upcoming all-race South African elections. The Space Shuttle Endeavour astronauts are wrapping up their last full day in space. The crew is scheduled to return home tomorrow, ending a 10-day mission. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
The crew is spending today mapping the North Sea and the snow-capped Himalayas using radar that creates 3D images of the surface below. Scientists involved with the space radar experiment say they have mapped all of their intended targets, roughly twice the area of the United States. The Space Radar Laboratory is intended to study global environment, but astronauts say they did not need radar to see some of the planet's environmental problems. The laboratory will fly aboard Endeavour once again in August. Tomorrow's landing at the Kennedy Space Center is scheduled for 11:53 Eastern Time. Forecasters say the weather will be favorable. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
Police in Barcelona, Spain, say one person died when two grenades were fired from a car into the local police headquarters. 10 people were hurt. The car later blew up. No one else was injured. It's not clear who launched the attack. The Federal Reserve has moved to increase short-term interest rates. It's the third hike this year. Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan made a brief announcement today saying the central bank will increase pressure slightly on its reserve positions. Analysts think this will result in a rate hike of about a quarter point. This affected Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrials dropped more than 41 points to close at 3,620.42. Declines led advances in heavy trading. This is NPR. The Boston Marathon has been won. Uta Pippig of Germany has won the women's division of the race. She set a course record of 2 hours, 21 minutes, and 45 seconds. Cosmas Nditi of Kenya has won the men's division. His time, 2 hours, 7 minutes, and 14 seconds. Japan's ruling coalition appears to be close to picking a new prime minister. The country's ruling and opposition camps, as well as government business, have been paralyzed since Prime Minister Morihiro Hosokawa resigned 10 days ago. NPR's Marjorie Sum reports from Tokyo.
Foreign Minister Tsutomu Hata is likely to be the nation's next prime minister. The leaders of the several parties belonging to the ruling coalition may meet tomorrow to nominate him. The parliament might approve Hata as soon as Wednesday. Hata is a moderate and a former member of the Liberal Democratic Party. But he defected from the LDP last year. He's been head of the Ministries of Agriculture and Finance. Hata seems to have clinched the nomination today when another politician, Michio Watanabe, failed to defect from the LDP. Watanabe may still vote from the LDP, weakening its power base as the nation's biggest party, but Watanabe doesn't appear to have enough votes to win the job of prime minister. Meanwhile, the seven parties of the ruling coalition remain virtually intact, despite predictions last week of a significant realignment. I'm Marjorie Sun in Tokyo.
The United Nations says two peacekeepers and a UN worker have been killed in Somalia. Two Nepalese soldiers were killed in crossfire in fighting between two clans today, and a worker for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees has been shot to death. He was hit while his plane tried to land in a southern town. Meanwhile, the UN reports nearly $4 million has been stolen from its headquarters in Mogadishu. That's the worst case of theft there. The UN operation has been plagued by theft, especially since the United States withdrew its troops in March. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The new film Backbeat is about the early years of the Beatles. It's not a documentary, but it ain't Beatlemania either. In fact, musicians from Sonic Youth, R.E.M., Soul Asylum, and Nirvana play the music on the soundtrack.
Wait! Oh yes, wait a minute, Mr. Postman! Wait!
My guest is the co-writer and director of Backbeat, Ian Softley. Film critic Owen Gleiberman describes Backbeat as a loving reenactment of the years before the Beatles were stars, when they were just a rough-and-tumble bar band playing hard-rocking cover versions of Good Golly Miss Molly and the grimy Rathskellers of Hamburg, Germany. The central characters are John Lennon and his buddy, artist Stuart Sutcliffe, who was the Beatles' first bass player back when there were five members of the band. Sutcliffe died of a brain hemorrhage just as the Beatles were becoming famous. He had already left the band to go back to painting. In this early scene from the film, Lennon is trying to convince Sutcliffe to give up his promising painting career to play rock and roll. Sutcliffe is worried about what his mentor will think.
I know what Arthur's gonna say. He's gonna say, I gave you a chance. I put a brush in your hand. Went out on a limb for you, and you're going to toss it away to go and play bass in John Lennon's skiffle band.
It's not a skiffle band.
He's going to say...
It's a rock and roll band.
I open the doors for
it's
you.
It's not my band.
Yeah, that's what he'll say.
It's a group. We're a group. I like Arthur. You know, he's all right. But he thinks art's something you've got to hang on the wall in a pool of light. It's a disease with him. He thinks it's all about Van Gogh.
Nothing wrong with Van Gogh.
Oh, no, I had away with Van Gogh.
Did you?
Bumped into him, you're nice in the grapes.
Yeah?
Yeah. St. Vincent, mate, where did it all go wrong? You know what he said? He mean to tell you this.
Yeah, what'd he say?
He said, if I could do it all again, I'd be up there shaking me bum doing blue suede shoes.
How did you find this Stu Sutcliffe story?
Well, it was at that time that I, when I was actively looking and kind of playing around with some ideas, that I was in a bookshop flicking through a load of music books, and I came across one photograph in particular, a very beautiful self-portrait that Astrid Kircher took. And I was just immediately struck by this photograph. It looked as though this woman not only was very beautiful, very, very attractive, with short, cropped blonde hair, looking very directly into the camera, but she had taken the photograph herself, and it was beautifully composed. It had an incredible timeless quality about it, as if it could have appeared in the pages of a fashion or style magazine today. And so I flicked through to the index and looked up her name and kind of went through other books and saw her photographs she'd taken of Stuart and photographs she'd taken of the Beatles when they were still really kids in Hamburg. And the characters that I saw in these photographs just kind of jumped off the page, and I knew that there was a great film here.
Astrid Kircher, who was Stu Sutcliffe's lover and also a German photographer who took fantastic early pictures of the Beatles, she's still alive. Did she help you with the movie?
Yeah, I think one of the most direct influences that Astrid had on the film was really just in allowing me and later on the actors to really get into her, to get into, to sort of travel back in time with her, really, by having a relationship with that person. I think I, and certainly the actors, felt drawn into that world, so that we weren't looking at it from the outside. But she was generous enough to sort of share her memories, but also to become friends with us, and so that we were getting to know the essence of the people. It wasn't so much a kind of list of chronological facts that I got from Astrid, although I did get a lot of that. What was really powerful to me and very inspirational was when I finally got the funds together to be able to contract her, I went to stay with her and Klaus Voormann in a North German farmhouse and spent many days doing taped interviews with her, talking late into the night, looking through boxes of letters and documents of time with Stuart, and just talking about scenes, going back to incidences again and again and looking at them from a different angle. And I really felt that I was being drawn back and drawn into that relationship.
Are there parts of the Beatles story that you think come into focus when you examine the Beatles through the life of Stu Sutcliffe?
Yeah, I think one of the things that interested me when I realized that the three characters, Astrid, Stuart, and John, were fascinating characters for a movie, was that through their relationship, not only do we see a universal love story, if you like, but we see a story about people making decisions about what they're going to do with their lives and what they have to give up in terms of relationships to sometimes get what they want. But also, it's as if the time in Hamburg is like a microcosm of a lot of the things that happened later. We see a coming together of two worlds, of art and rock and roll, Liverpool and Hamburg, kind of male and female impulses.
And the pop and the avant-garde.
But I think what's interesting about the world at that time in Hamburg is that Stuart Sutcliffe's decision, the choice that he has to make between his best friend John Lennon and his lover Astrid Kirke, is also the decision between playing in a rock and roll band and being an artist. And what we see by the end of the film is a kind of synthesis, a coming together of these two worlds in the relationship of Stuart and Astrid. And that relationship having a very big influence on John and through John the Beatles, and eventually the whole kind of themes and preoccupations of 60s popular culture. I mean, I think it's not going too far to say that you can actually trace this kind of mixture of European art school and an American rock and roll culture as being in many ways the defining quality of the Beatles in terms of what made them different to other rock and roll bands.
My guest is Ian Softley, co-writer and director of the new film Backbeat, about the early days of the Beatles. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Ian Softley, director of the new film Backbeat. Your movie Backbeat takes place just before the Beatles' first recording session. Even though the Beatles at the time were already performing Lennon-McCartney songs, you don't use any of those songs in the movie. Did you have trouble buying the rights to those songs? Were the rights too expensive?
No, that's not the way around that things happen. And I think I mean, the whole idea about using the songs that we used, there was a very important creative reason, which I've talked about a bit, which is the idea of this band doing covers of other people's songs, of their heroes' songs, puts us in their shoes more. It makes us feel that they're like us. That these are ordinary guys who've got their rock and roll heroes. If the only songs or the majority of songs that we heard them do were Beatles songs, I think it would be like us looking up at them on a pedestal. And that this is, in a way, a kind of an anti-history, to the extent that it's a history at all. It's seeing... One of the things that struck me about the idea was that this was a way of seeing a story that people have an enormous kind of preconceptions about, and kind of turning them upside down, looking at them from the other point of view, seeing the Beatles as the bad boys in the way that everybody thought the Rolling Stones were, and before they became kind of perhaps over-molded in the early days, as they were in the early days of their career.
Why don't I play something from the soundtrack that's been released along with the film? Why don't we hear Good Golly, Miss Molly? Do you want to say anything about this performance?
Good Golly, Miss Molly is the first song that the guys do in the Kaiserkeller, the club that they play in Hamburg. In the movie, we see them coming on stage to a very unwelcoming audience. And it's really a kind of... either they've got to run away or they've got to stand and fight, in a way. And they fight through this song. They just kind of blast it out to the people in the club, demanding to be listened to.
Let's hear it. From the soundtrack recording of the film Backbeat, and my guest Ian Softley is the co-writer and the director of the film. If you wanted the music in the film to be true to the energy of the early Beatles music, what did you want the visual look of the film to be like?
I wanted the film to be true to the world seen through the eyes of these artists. I wanted it to feel as if we were there now, to a certain extent, but I also wanted to, I wanted the style and the look to be dictated by what they were experiencing, what it would have looked like through their eyes. So at times when they're going to Astrid's apartment and some of the Hamburg art scene bars, there's a kind of sense in which that's heightened and stylized, as if their senses are sort of experiencing the colors and the light and shade more vividly. And I think also there's a sense in which the look of the film reflects both the use of kind of rich colors in Stuart's paintings, particularly blacks and reds, and also we tried to reflect the composition and use of light and shade, strong light and shade, in Astrid's photographs. Her photographs are very simple, graphic, strong compositions that have a kind of an authentic feel, a kind of real personality, but at the same time, there's an aesthetic there as well.
From the way you tell the story in the film, Astrid Kirko, the photographer, had an influence on the Beatles' visual style. And in fact, she may be responsible for the Beatles' haircut.
Astrid had a very big influence on the Beatles' look in a number of ways. I mean, specifically, she cut Stuart's hair so that Stuart looked like her, which became the way that the Beatles themselves cut the hair afterwards, and known as the mop top. She also gave them a lot of other ideas about clothes. I mean, in general, she would kind of adapt and alter clothes, cut the colors off jackets and things, and their collarless jackets and their high-heeled Cuban-heeled flamenco boots can be seen as something that Astrid first dressed Stuart in, that was then taken on by the others. I think the way that she photographed them was a very big influence, and kind of opened their eyes to the power of the way they looked was going to be a very important part of what they did. In those early photographs in the Hamburg locations where she arranges them, making sure that they're not smiling, that there's a kind of dignity, sort of relationship between the bodies in the photograph, almost as if she's a sculptor arranging her models. Somehow, it's not just the first time that anybody had photographed the Beatles in that way. It's, I think, the first time a rock and roll band had been photographed in that way, dignifying them with a kind of a presence which suggested that they were going to have a power and an influence beyond merely playing music in a club on a Saturday night.
Yeah, her photographs weren't your typical rock and roll idol photographs with a singer looking dreamily into the character. These were poses with a lot of attitude, where maybe they'd each be standing there with their instrument, kind of posed at interesting angles, maybe on a bridge or something. So, it had this real sculptural, kind of hard-edge look to it.
And I think this idea and this acceptance of how the visual arts in particular, but all art, was in a way like a metaphor for the sort of the cultural change that was happening at the time, was something that that Astrid showed them, because she lived her art. And when she and Stuart were lovers, I mean, the divisions between their love and their art was very blurred. And I think in many ways one can see echoes in the relationships that some of these guys had later, which reflect the sort of relationship that Stuart and Astrid had, which was an odd relationship for the time when, you know, men were still supposed to be macho, even rock and rollers. And here was Stuart, in a way, kind of challenging sexual stereotypes by agreeing to be the model to his girlfriend, the artist, allowing her to cut his hair in so that he looked like her, pulling on her tight leather trousers, a kind of sexual ambivalence and androgyny that was a very important theme in the whole of the 60s culture, the breaking down of sexual stereotypes. Men growing their hair was considered a kind of an effeminate thing to do at that time. And I think that that's one of the themes that interested me, that it's here are these people at a time when all of these things are going around in their minds because of the age that they are, trying to work out their identity, not just as artists, but as people.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thanks very much.
Ian Softley is director of the new film Backbeat. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have from GarageDev?
Well, we'll be hearing from Andy Bowers in Zagreb about the latest from GarageDev, the Bosnian town that's been attacked by Bosnian Serbs. Also, we'll be hearing from Ann Garrels about what U.S. policy might be in response to that Bosnian Serb advance. Also on today's program, Linda Wertheimer on Nigeria's taste for imported food, a costly taste the country developed during its oil boom. And we'll be talking with historian David Hackett Fisher about Paul Revere's ride. It was really one of many rides on this night back in 1775.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says he's a big fan of electric guitarist Bill Frisell, whose new album is for sextet with three horns. Kevin says it's one of Frisell's best yet for his composing as well as his guitar playing.
Trombonist Curtis Folks and Bill Frisell on guitar. With his signature slow vibrato and heavy use of volume pedal, Frisell sounds sort of like he's playing rock guitar backwards at the wrong speed, and a little like he's playing good old country and western pedal steel. One way or another, Frisell always sounds like he's digging roots out of the ground while standing on his head. His new album is called This Land. That fits. The band is his regular trio plus trombone, clarinet, and alto sax. That's the sort of singular horn section Duke Ellington would put together, like on Mood Indigo. For Frisell, anything can be a source, and everything goes together. His tune Amarillo Barbados is kind of, what, mariachi reggae? Much as critics have written about the sound of the prairies in Frizzell's music, he had to point out his conspicuous Aaron Copland influence. He did it by putting Copland's Billy the Kid on his last record. On the new one, Frizzell's composition, Jimmy Carter, Part 2, sounds like a Copland setting of a sailor's hornpipe tune, the Great Plains blowing through a tin whistle. This Land is Frizzell's most ambitious record as a composer, but improvisation brings the written music to life. That's why he hired Don Byron to play clarinet. The horn players get their licks in, but if anyone steals this ensemble record, it's drummer Joey Barron. Some drummers swing, some make a racket. Barron forgot to choose. This is Unscientific Americans. That was the complete performance. You know, every musician has lots of influences, which work on him in different ways. We won't get into the link between Thelonious Monk's piano and Frizzell's guitar. Still, one drops the names of other composers not to take anything away from Frizzell, but to confirm the richness of his own style. Inspiration aside, he sounds like himself.
Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead writes for Downbeat, CD Review, Coda, and The Village Voice. He reviewed Bill Frizzell's new recording, This Land, on the Elektra Nonesuch label. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller, technical direction from Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our interns are Philo Holland, Ann Neville, and Devin Reeve. Naomi Person directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
What's behind the bloodshed in the Natal province in South Africa? On the next Fresh Air, with the elections a week away, we'll talk with South African writer Gerhard Marais, the author of a history of the Inkatha Freedom Party and Zulu chief Mangosuthu Buthelezi. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.